It's time for Bigler's World, bop-a-dop-a-dow, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. That's right. What do we got here? Several kids' magazines I'll be reading from today for the next hour. Let's see, I'm going to do some Dogo news eventually, some science news, maybe a little time for kids. But let's start with newsforkids.net. America 250 holds America's field trip contest. The United States will turn 250 years old on July 4th, 2026. As part of the celebrations, a group called America 250 is holding a special contest for students in grades 3 through 12. The winners will go on a field trip to one of several historical sites across the U.S. It's been a long time since America declared its independence on July 4th. 1776. Next year, the U.S. will mark its 250th birthday with some big celebrations. America 250 is a group officially in charge of organizing these events, and it wants to make sure that young people across the U.S. are included. So America 250 is holding a special contest for students in the U.S., grades 3 through 12. The contest is called America's Field Trip, and it will give winners a chance to visit different historical sites across the country. Are they repeating themselves or is it just me? To enter, students simply need to creatively answer the question, what does America mean to you? Students can create a written response, such as an essay, but artwork is also accepted and encouraged. The contest is meant to encourage students to consider what America really means to them. Winners will get a chance to learn more about American history and to make friends with students from around the country. Rosie Rios, who leads America 250, says, America's field trip is a fun and meaningful way for students all over the country to think about what it means to be part of America's story. Ms. Rios, whose parents came to the U.S., there it is, from Mexico, knows something about becoming part of America's story. She grew up to become the 43rd treasurer of the United States. The contest is judged at three different levels: elementary school, that's 3 through 5th grade, middle school, 6th through 8th, and high school, 9th through 12th grade. America 250 says it has already gotten entries from each of the 50 states. First prize winners at each level will win a special 3-day trip to one of America's most famous landmarks, such as Mount Rushmore, Yellowstone National Park, or Independence Hall in Philadelphia. There are 14 different field trips in all, including more recent American history, such as a trip to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or to see Hamilton in New York City. The trips will include behind-the-scenes tours and chances to see things that most people never get to see. Last year, America 250 ran a similar contest. The students from across the U.S. took part. The students who won field trips seemed to love their experiences, not just for the places they saw, but for what they learned and the people they met. Camden, an 11th grader, said, "This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that I recommend for anyone who wants to learn more about our country." Ms. Rios says, "This program isn't just about winning a field trip. It's about helping students connect with our history and imagine the kind of future they want to help create." It says here, "Did you know the special word for a 250-year celebration is a semi-quincentennial? A quincentennial marks 500 years since something has happened. Since the semi means half, semi-quincentennial, I think I blew that, basically means half of a 500-year celebration." Okay, they got some more information on the contest. The deadline for the contest is April 16th of 2025. It is open to all students, grades 3 through 12, who are legal residents of the U.S., states, or its territories. This includes homeschooled students. There will be 25 first prize winners at each grade level. Each grade level will also have 25 second prize winners who will win $500. All entries must be submitted by an adult, such as a parent or a teacher. The very best entry at each grade level will also earn a $1,000 prize for the student's teacher. Okay, more details and suggestions can be found at America 250 website. Okay, next article here on Bigler's World on Sun Sounds. Let's go to another publication. Dogo News for Kids. It's news for kids. Teen-created app makes calorie tracking effortless. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. Ever wondered how many calories are on your plate? Cal AI, a smart fitness app, gives you instant answers. Simply take a picture of the food, and the app will provide you with accurate calorie and nutritional breakdown to help you make smarter dietary choices. Cal AI is the brainchild of Zach Yadigari. The 18-year-old teenager came up with the idea in 2023 after struggling with traditional calorie counting apps. And he says this, "I was tracking calories on my Fitness Pal." That's all one word, my Fitness Pal, he explains. "After 3 days, I quit. I was finding so much trouble using their app, typing in everything. It was very tedious and very burdensome to do." Determined to find a better way, Yadigari teamed up with some high school friends to build a simpler, more accurate tool. They focused on precise calorie counting and nutrition breakdown. The young coders trained Cal AI using images from three different AI models. This enabled it to recognize ingredients in packaged food and complex meals like mixed bowls. The final challenge was estimating portion sizes. This was solved by comparing user photos to standard portions. And just to show you that, they have a stack of pancakes about 10 inches high. The founders assert in this picture, that Cal AI is 90% accurate in identifying foods and estimating calories. Its accuracy improves continuously with user feedback. Since its May 2024 launch, Cal AI has been downloaded over 5 million times. More than 30% of users continue to use the app. In February 2025 alone, it generated over $2 million in revenue, and the numbers continue to grow. Cal AI's success is largely attributed to viral marketing. Yadigari uses his own social media feed to identify fitness influencers who can effectively promote Cal AI to their followers. As a result, Cal AI is particularly popular among young users ages 15 to 25. Yadigari will graduate from high school this summer with a 4.0 GPA. Although he has been accepted to multiple universities, he plans to take a gap year to focus on Cal AI, which now has 17 employees. His goals include improving the app's accuracy beyond 90% and expanding its appeal to users of all ages. Next article, sticking with Dogo News for Kids. Saturn strengthens its Moon King status with 128 new moons. Those are brand new, by the way. We didn't know they were there, apparently. Soumaya Kalluru wrote this article. With 146 moons, Saturn had already surpassed its closest competitor, Jupiter, which has a mere 95. The discovery of 128 more has pushed Saturn's total to 274, further cementing its title as the Moon King. There's another version of that. This is nearly twice the combined total of all other planets. Who is this? Edward Ashton, the study's lead researcher. He's Dr. Edward Ashton. He says this, "Sure enough, we found 128 new moons. Based on our projections, I don't think Jupiter will ever catch up." The moons were detected between 2019 and 2023 using the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope in Hawaii, but they were not officially recognized by the International Astronomical Union until March 11th of 2025. Some are less than 2.5 miles across. In comparison, Saturn's largest moon, Titan, measures about 3,199 miles wide. However, all have verified orbits around Saturn. This is a key requirement for an object to be considered a moon. The newly discovered moons are irregular. That means that their orbits are tilted compared to the flat plane of Saturn's rings and larger moons. With these additions, the planet now has 250 irregular moons. They are grouped into three families based on their orbits. You got Inuit, you got Gallic, and you've got Norse. Okay, most of the new moons belong to the Norse group, which orbits Saturn in reverse, opposite to the planet's rotation. I don't like that. That's no good. The researchers think these moons are fragments of larger space rocks that collided and broke apart less than 100 million years ago. The pieces were later pulled into orbit by Saturn's gravity, and closer examination could provide insights into the early solar system when such collisions were far more common. Next article. Sticking with Dogo, 2,600-year-old Phoenician shipwreck recovered off Spanish coast. Leanne Humphreys wrote this article. Spanish archaeologists have recovered a largely intact shipwreck dating back nearly 2,600 years. The 27-foot-long trading vessel was carrying lead ingots to an unknown destination when it sank off the coast of Mazarrón, Spain. It remained hidden in the sand just 6 feet below the ocean's surface until divers finally found it back in 1994. The shipwreck was particularly interesting to researchers because it is one of only a few well-preserved vessels from the Phoenician era. The Phoenicians lived along the eastern Mediterranean coast from the 16th to the 4th century BCE. These skilled boat builders traveled widely, trading goods like glass, timber, and metals. Officials named the precious artifact Mazarrón II and covered it with a metal cage to protect it from damage. But in 2019, divers found that the metal box was sinking. Worried it might crush the wreck, they urged authorities to take action. In the summer of 2023, archaeologists began planning the extraction of the vessel from the seafloor. They spent over 560 hours underwater, creating detailed drawings of its structure. These drawings aimed to guide craftsmen in restoring the ship once it was brought to the surface. Between September and November of 2024, 14 divers carefully removed the wreck in 22 sections. The pieces were sent to the Museum of Underwater Archaeology in southern Spain. To preserve the ship, experts will first remove the salt from each fragment. Then they will apply resins to areas where the wood has rotted. Finally, the pieces will be freeze-dried to remove water from the wood. The ship will then be reassembled. The restoration is expected to take about 4 years. Upon completion, Mazarrón II will be showcased at a local museum. It will offer researchers invaluable insights into Phoenician shipbuilding techniques. Let's see, who is this? Way down here, Agustin Diaz. He's a historian at the University of Valencia, and he says, "It will tell us what types of wood were used to build the boat, where it was built, what navigation was like at the time, the degradation process of the wood, the contamination that may have occurred in shallow waters." Oh, yes. A second Phoenician ship, the Mazarrón I, was discovered in the same area back in 1993. It was less intact, but Spanish officials extracted and restored it in 1995. The ship is now on display in the Museum of Cartagena, Spain. The exact cause of the sinkings remain unknown, but experts believe the same powerful storm may have brought down both ships. Next article here. Once again, Dogo. They got a lot of good articles here in this particular Dogo for kids. Turning textile waste into stronger packaging paper. Alvaro Aragon wrote this article. Fast fashion has made clothing cheaper than ever, but at a high environmental cost. Earth.org estimates that about 92 million tons of unwanted clothing end up in landfills every year. That is the equivalent of a garbage truck of full clothes being dumped every second. Thomas Harter, and his team at Austria's Graz University of Technology hope to rescue this waste by using discarded clothes to create stronger packaging material. The researchers start by shredding the clothing and soaking it in water-based solution. The mixture is then put through a milling machine. This separates the cotton fibers from the fabric without causing knots or clumps. Next, the fiber mix is combined with recycled paper pulp used to produce materials like cardboard. Then it is run through traditional paper-making machines. The result is a stronger paper than that made from recycled paper fibers alone. This is because textile fibers, which are much longer than regular paper fibers, fit together better. The textile reinforced paper has a slight brown tint with flecks of color from the dyed fabrics. However, this does not affect the sustainability for packaging materials or cardboard boxes. Most importantly, it can be recycled just like regular paper. Let's see, who is this? Somebody's says harder. Strictly speaking, the conversion of textile fibers into paper is a downgrade. However, it has a major advantage from an environmental point of view. The paper cycle is highly closed, with recycling rates of over 90% in the packaging sector. The technology is still in its early stages. The team hopes to make the process more efficient by using mild acids and other chemicals to help break down the fibers. This would reduce the need for intense milling, speed up production, and lower costs. Once ready, this innovation could significantly reduce global textile waste. And an added bonus, this stronger packaging paper would last longer. This would reduce the amount of paper waste generated during packaging production. And let's do one more article here in Dogo News. The ISS may be too clean for its own good, says John Wu, who I guess wrote this. I don't know. With advanced air filters and strict cleaning routines, the International Space Station, ISS, is one of the cleanest places beyond Earth. Yet astronauts often experience a range of health issues while on board. A new study suggests that one reason may be that the ISS is too clean. For their research, Rodolfo Benitez and his team at UC San Diego asked astronauts to wipe different parts of the ISS to collect samples. This included the kitchen, bathroom, and eating area. Over 800 samples were collected and sent back to Earth for analysis. The results showed a lack of good environmental microbes. These are the kind typically found in soil, water, and plants on Earth. The only microbes present were human-related. They included bacteria from the astronauts' skin and the food they ate. Also, though cleaning had been stopped a few days before the samples were taken, the swabs showed high levels of chemical residue. The researchers suggest that the lack of diverse microbes in the constant cleaning may cause the immune system to struggle to function normally. This could explain why astronauts often experience cold sores, skin rashes, and other issues while in orbit. The study's findings were published in the journal Cell, as in C-E-L-L, back February 27, 2025. They are particularly important for future missions to the moon and beyond. To ensure astronauts remain healthy, scientists will have to find ways to bring good germs into the mix. This could be done by bringing animals or plants aboard the spacecraft. Let's see, who is this? Pieter Dorenstein. He's a biochemist at UC San Diego. He says this: "The reality is that we are going to inhabit space at some point, so this work will give us the first insight in terms of the things that we need to add and remove. The most important message that we can pass on is how important it is to not only look at what is present, but what is absent." Yikes. That guy scared me. Let's go to another magazine here. Let's do a little National Geographic for kids. They got a thing on Alabama. I don't think I know anything about Alabama. Are they still a state? Yeah, they are. Get the facts and photos about this 22nd state. They haven't seceded from the Union again? I don't know. Fast facts, the nickname is the Heart of Dixie. That's Alabama. Statehood was way back in 1819, the 22nd state. Population, as of July 2015, which is 10 years ago, 4,858,979. The capital is Montgomery. The biggest city is Birmingham. The abbreviation is AL. The state bird is the yellowhammer. Yikes. You know, that's a bird, I guess. State flower is a camellia. And here's the history. More than 10,000 years ago, they're going way back, people came to the area that is now Alabama, some living in Russell Cave. The thousands of years later, Native American tribes such as the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creek resided in the area. Although many Native Americans were forced to leave Alabama in the 1800s, today some descendants of those tribes still live in the state. Spanish explorers first arrived in the 1500s. The area was controlled at different points by England, France, and then Spain again. It was finally signed over to the United States, along with what is now Mississippi, in the 1795 Treaty of San Lorenzo. In 1819, Alabama became a U.S. state. It would leave the Union in 1861 and rejoin it after the Civil War. In the 1950s and 60s, Alabama was at the center of the civil rights movement. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white man in Montgomery. Many protests against segregation followed, often led by Martin Luther King Jr. So, why is it called Alabama? The state's name comes from the Alabama Tribe, one of the Native American groups from that area. You see, I didn't know anything about this. Dixie is a nickname for southern states, especially the Confederate states, which left the Union during the Civil War. Alabama is called the Heart of Dixie because Montgomery, Alabama, was the first Confederate capital. Okay, what do we got here? Geography and landforms. This southern state is bordered by Tennessee in the north, Georgia in the east, Florida and Mobile Bay in the south, and Mississippi in the west. The Highland Rim in the northwest is where you'll find the Tennessee River Valley, while the Cumberland Plateau in the northeast is named for its flat-topped plateaus. I guess that's why the plateau is there. Just southeast is the Appalachian Ridge and Valley, which includes the Coosa River, C-O-O-S-A, the Coosa River and iron-rich Red Mountain. The Piedmont Upland in the central eastern part of the state is a hilly area with Alabama's highest peak, 2,407-foot Cheeha, the Cheeha Mountain. The rest of the state is called the East Gulf Coastal Plain, which contains both flatlands and hills, plus the Alabama, the state's longest river, at 314 miles long. Wildlife. Two of North America's rarest species, the Perdido, is that the Perdido Key Beach Mouse? Okay, and the Alabama Beach Mouse. They hide out in Alabama, of course. Coyotes, armadillos, deer, feral pigs, and American alligators also roam the land. Birds such as kites, bald eagles, and hawks dot the skies. And the Gulf Coast water dog and the 20-inch eastern hellbender, the biggest salamander species by weight in North America, are underfoot. Well, hopefully not literally underfoot. Bamboo and mistletoe grow in the state, as well as other parts of the country, but the carnivorous Alabama canebake pitcher plant, the Alabama glade cress, and the Cahaba prairie clover can only be found here. The state's 100-plus type trees include pines, red cedars, magnolias, and live oaks, which are often draped with long, gray Spanish moss. Natural resources. About 70% of Alabama is covered in forest, so it's no wonder the state is known for its timber. Alabama's vast forests would cover Rhode Island, Delaware, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Alabama is also rich in limestone, coal, and iron ore, which are the three raw materials needed to make steel. In fact, Alabama is home to three of the nation's top pipe-making companies. Here's some fun stuff. Famous Alabamans include country singer Hank Williams, educator Booker T. Washington, inventor George Washington Carver, jazz singer Nat King Cole, and author Harper Lee. Visit Ivy Green, the birthplace of Helen Keller, and touch the pump where the activist, who was born deaf and blind, first learned the word water. Tour the White House of the Confederacy in Montgomery, where the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, lived for a period of time during the Civil War. And last one they got here, NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center is in Huntsville. Tour the nearby U.S. Space and Rocket Center, the world's largest spaceflight museum and home to Space Camp. Okay, next article, sticking with National Geographic, right here on Bigler's World. Let's do a moment of yum. Animal eats. Every creature has to eat, from crabs to orangutans, leatherbacks, sea turtles to chameleons. So grab a snack and check out some hungry critters. I will. First one they got here, they got a picture of, looks like a mouse-type creature. To people, dandelions are pesky weeds, but to an American pika, they are a tasty treat. It's an American pika. All American. How about this one? Sally Lightfoot crabs, found among the rocky coasts of North and South America, eat fish, sponges, mollusks, and other sea creatures. And when a wave comes, the crabs hold on tight to the rocks and their food. The crab has a yellow body, looks like in red arms, and claws. That's quite attractive. What do they got here? Come and get it. This starling has hungry mouths to feed and will leave the nest up to 400 times a day to find insects. They got a picture of it with its wings all the way back, caught in action, about to, I don't know if that's an insect. Looks like an insect. It's about to poke down one of its offspring's beak. And for some reason, this orangutan has, I'm going to say, about 15 bananas stuck in its mouth. Either it's holding them up. I can't tell from the photograph. Orangutans spend their days traveling to find fruit, which makes up over half of their diet. This ape is going bananas. I can't tell if those bananas are all sticking out of its mouth or not. How about this? Living in the Galapagos Islands, large marine iguanas feed on algae at high tide, swimming under the waves to grab a meal. Smaller iguanas nibble on the plants during low tide. I got a picture of one underwater grazing. Let's see. They got a picture of a lizard with its tongue. Is that a gecko? Its tongue is longer than its body from this photograph. Found in Madagascar, the panther chameleon, which can be as long as its body, the tongue can be as long as its body, uses suction cup to grasp prey. Oh, the suction cup is the end of the tongue, okay? It's just a freaky photograph. What about this? The leatherback sea turtle eats slippery sea creatures, so its throat is lined with spines to keep prey from escaping back out. That's a good thing I have, I guess. This long-tailed macaque of Southeast Asia may look happy that it has found some fruit. Looks like a coconut. But the monkey's bared teeth and defensive position actually say, back off, this snack is mine. Or, you're my snack. You're the next snack. This is the last one here. Let's see if I can pronounce this. The Anahinga, A-N-H-I-N-G-A. The Anahinga, it's a bird from North and South America, likes to play with its food. It's got a real long neck here. The bird will toss a fish into the air until it can swallow the meal head first. That's classy. And let's do one more article from National Geographic Kids magazine. I think this is pronounced Songkran. It's spelled like that, S-O-N-G-K-R-A-N. Songkran, get the scoop on this splashy spring festival in Thailand. Rosie Davidson, or Rose Davidson, rather, wrote this one here. Bring out the water hoses and don't be afraid to get a little wet. Songkran, a festival marking the Thai New Year, is all about making a fresh start with a splash. Water, water, everywhere. The festival in Thailand kicks off on April 13th, or it did, and usually lasts 3 days, though festivities can start early or end later in some cities. The holiday's main focus is about moving forward. In fact, the word Songkran comes from a phrase in the Sanskrit language that means passage of the sun. Water plays a major role in the festival. Symbolically, it washes away the previous year so people can get ready for the next one. But many other Songkran traditions use water as well. Spring cleaning. People prepare for the new year by cleaning houses, schools, offices, and other public spaces. They're joined by family members who have moved away and return for the holiday to spend time with loved ones. Many families wake up early during Songkran to visit Buddhist temples where they bring offerings such as food and listen to monks as they preach. Buddhism, it says here in parentheses, is a religion practiced mostly in Eastern and Central Asia. Visitors sprinkle clean or scented water over statues of Buddha, the person believed to have started Buddhism, to represent purification and good fortune. Younger people also pour water on the hands of poor elderly relatives and friends to show their respect and ask for blessings in the coming year. Some temple visitors bring sand, which is meant to replenish the sand that's been carried away on shoes throughout the year. They leave the sand in stupas, or mounds, on the ground, which are then decorated with colorful flags and flowers. Super soaked. Honoring family traditions and religious practices are important parts of Songkran, but so is having some fun. Outside, Songkran is celebrated with street parties, featuring loud music and a giant friendly water fight. At least at first. People collect water in buckets, squirt guns, and anything else they can find. Then they hit the streets to playfully splash each other. It's a good thing April is one of the hottest months of the year in Thailand. Okay, let us go to another magazine entirely. But not before I remind you, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. That's right. Or at least you're listening to Jim Bigler. On Bigler's World, let's do a little science news. Science News Explores. The name of this article, biological sex is more complex than just male or female. People show a wide range of variation that defies such a simple either-or definition. Who wrote this? Tina Hespensay wrote this. Starts off with, sex isn't as simple as male or female. It's not just about chromosomes or genitals or reproductive cells or any other binary metric. Binary refers to something that can only take one of two either-or states. People have a huge range of genetic, environmental, and developmental variations. These can produce, in the same person, a mix of what we are thought of as masculine and feminine traits. When it comes to sex, millions of people don't fit a narrow binary definition. Through no fault of their own, and many don't even know it. Instead, scientists say sex should be viewed in all of its complex glory. Let's see who's talking here. Sam Sharp, he's an evolutionary biologist at Kansas State University in Manhattan. He says, sex is a multifaceted trait that has some components that are present at birth and some components that develop during puberty. This underscores the challenge with trying to say someone is male or female based on just one trait, such as what reproductive cells, eggs, or sperm they can make. In fact, defining sex by just the size of sex cells, those eggs versus sperm, says, who is this, Anna Biasen-Lauber. She calls this type of definition really painful. Who is she? She's a pediatric endocrinologist. She works at the University of Freiburg in Switzerland, and she says, in fact, defining sex by just the size of the sex cells reduces a human being to the chance of reproducing. Kind of wish I hadn't done that now. What's more, such a definition is not biologically accurate. It leaves out people who don't make any reproductive cells, also called gametes. That can be caused by being born with certain genetic variants. What does that mean for people who don't have gametes? Sharp asks. That is, as of now, an unanswered question. But it's an important question to answer because you can't have a definition of sex that doesn't apply to everyone. No. A person's defined sex may affect many aspects of daily life, such as which public restroom they can use, or getting an ID card or passport, or joining a sports team. So any definition of sex needs to account for existing variation, Sharp and other researchers say. Sex is complicated, says the next slug here at the top of this section here. Nathan Lentz, he's a molecular evolutionary biologist at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He says biology doesn't operate in binaries very often. Reproductive cells are just about as close to true binary as nature gets, he says. There are two types of gametes, eggs and sperm. Egg cells are much larger than sperm. But sex is more than types of reproductive cells, he and other researchers point out. Most traits ascribed to males and females fall along a spectrum that has two peaks. One is the average for females, the other is average for males. On the average, males are taller than females. Males also, on average, have more muscle mass, more red blood cells, and a higher metabolism. But almost nobody fits in the peak for their sex on all of those measures, Lentz says. There's plenty of women who are taller than plenty of men, he says, or who have higher metabolic rates than some men. A definition of biological sex based on just gametes misses rather all of the complexity. you're going to ignore most of what actually matters to your daily life, he says. When does sex stop? Human sex development starts in the womb. That exact timing is hard to pinpoint, but it's several weeks after conception, Baez Luber says. Scientists used to think that embryos automatically developed as female unless they were specific instructions to become male. But in the last decade, researchers have learned that's not true. To develop as females, embryos must actively dismantle male-producing structures, and they have to build ones that support female reproduction. About 6 weeks into gestation, cells appear that will eventually give rise to ovaries, that's the tissue that makes the eggs, or testes, the tissue that can make sperm. But for a couple of weeks, Baez and Luber says, those cells are absolutely indistinguishable from each other. At about 8 weeks into gestation, certain cells in what will become the testes begin to make testosterone. This hormone is important for development of the scrotum and penis and other male reproductive organs, but males don't make sperm at this point. That's because testosterone levels dip late in pregnancy, and they stay low until puberty. Then testosterone kicks in once more, and at this point, immature cells can morph into sperm. Ovaries don't produce any sex hormones in the fetus, and the uterus, fallopian tubes, and vagina develop without any input from hormones, Bison Luber says. Females are born with all the eggs they will ever make. Those cells are in a state of suspended animation, though. They stay that way until puberty. Only then can they mature and start being released. Sex chromosomes can have lots of variations, is the next section here. Those developmental processes are partially directed by X and Y chromosomes. Though often called sex chromosomes, that name is somewhat misleading. In fact, X and Y chromosomes have a wide range of jobs. The X chromosome contains hundreds of genes. They play a role in processes throughout the body. Blood clotting, color vision, and brain development are just a few. The Y chromosome is much smaller than the X and has many fewer genes. It does contain genes important for male sex development and fertility, but other genes on it play a role in immunity, heart health, and cancer. Females generally have two X chromosomes. Males typically have an X and a Y, but there are plenty of variations on that theme, Baez and Luber notes. For instance, in Turner syndrome, women lack one X chromosome. They do have a uterus, but no ovaries, so they can't make gametes. If sex were defined by which gamete you made, Baez and Luber wonders, what sex would someone with Turner's syndrome be? And this condition is not all that rare, she adds. Some one in every 2,000 to 2,500 female babies are born with it. Many won't find out until adulthood. Others may never be diagnosed. About one in every 650 male babies are born with two or more X chromosomes and one Y. This is called Klinefelter syndrome. Many men with this won't learn that they have an extra chromosome unless they go for fertility treatments. These people have testes and penises, but they don't, however, make sperm. So a definition based on gametes would leave these people out. One gene on the Y chromosome is called SRI. It's important for male sex development, but not essential. Sometimes SRY jumps out of the Y chromosome when the chromosomes are divvied up before sperm production. It can attach itself to an X or some other chromosome. If the hitchhiking SRY gene is passed on, it may result in people who have two X chromosomes plus a stray SRY gene. These people will develop as males, but lacking a full Y chromosome, they won't make sperm. Some people have an X and a Y chromosome, but carry a version of SRY or changes in other genes. That doesn't spur typical male development. These people develop as females, but don't make eggs. Other people with an X and a Y may have versions of some genes that prevent their bodies from responding to testosterone and other male sex hormones. Those people have testes inside their abdomens, but the rest of their bodies develop as female. Variants in many other genes may also prevent production of either eggs or sperm. Some people even have different combinations of sex chromosomes in different cells of their bodies. Being intersex isn't all that rare. In practice, a person's sex is usually assigned at birth based on external genitals. A baby with a vulva is labeled a girl. A baby with testes and a penis is labeled a boy. But even at birth, some people don't fit neatly into male or female boxes. About 1.7% of the population is intersex. That is according to Interact, an advocacy organization for intersex youth. This rate is as common as having naturally red hair. Yikes. Sex development in intersex people can differ in any of a wide variety of ways, including the described above. Some may be born with both ovarian and testicular tissue. Under some definitions of sex, they might be considered both male and female, says Sylvan Fraser Anthony, Interact's legal and policy advisor. Intersex individuals often undergo surgeries as infants or young children to make their genitals or internal organs conform to the sex their parents choose. They may also need to take hormones, such as estrogen or testosterone, to maintain their health, says Sharp. Such hormones also play an important role in many facets of development, Sharp says. That includes whether your skin is painfully dry or not, or how tall you grow during puberty, or whether you're able to maintain bone density. With so much natural variation among people, trying to define sex by any single factor is bound to create confusion. Plus, unless they need to for medical reasons, most people never have their gametes or chromosomes checked, so neither is a practical way to define whether someone is male or female. Lentz says, the biology of sex and gender makes it very clear. These are not hard categories with clear definitions. Okay, let's do one more article from Science News Explorers. Let's see, this is from the explainer section. What is asthma and how is it treated? Drugs can reduce this chronic narrowing of lung airways that can make breathing difficult, says Sajal Parekh. I got a picture of a woman here with an inhaler. She's out on the beach. Apparently the beach triggers something. What do we got here? Juliana Hayes is a 10-year-old who lives in New Hampshire. She has a black belt in karate, loves ice cream flavor tornado, and wants to be a teacher. She also has asthma. This chronic lung condition can make it hard to breathe. People with asthma may feel fine most of the time, but if they encounter a trigger, such as smoke or animal fur, an attack may come on. During such an attack, people often cough, wheeze, and feel tired. Most of the time, Juliana says, I feel like I imagine any other person without asthma would feel, but sometimes during an asthma attack, my chest will get tight, and I can't breathe in all the way. Luckily, Juliana has not had such an attack in a while. I feel relieved that I've been diagnosed and that I have the right medication. More than 26 million people in the United States, roughly one in every 13, have asthma. Some may treat their condition with inhalers. Others need newer medications, such as monthly shots. The good news, having asthma does not need to stop you from doing what you want. With proper treatments, people with asthma can live normal lives. Hard to breathe. Asthma affects how air moves through the lungs. When you inhale, air flows from your mouth or nose, through your windpipe and into your lungs. The windpipe is a bit like the trunk of a tree that splits into two branches, one leading to each lung. Within the lungs, these big branches split off into smaller and smaller branches. At the end of the tiniest branches, where a tree's leaves would be, your lungs have small air sacs. The walls of these balloon-like sacs are only one cell wide. Yikes. Here, your blood sucks up oxygen from the air. Robin Cohen is a doctor at Boston Medical Center in Massachusetts. She treats children with lung diseases. I kept doing it. In someone with asthma, she says, the breathing tubes basically get swollen so that the tunnel inside the tube is narrowed. she explains. That makes it harder to pull air into the lungs. To make matters worse, some things can trigger small muscles around the outside of the airways to tighten. This squeezes the branches, narrowing the airspace inside them even more. This sudden constriction causes an asthma attack. Triggers can include pollutants and other things in the environment, such as pet dander that's flaked off bits of skin. Viruses that cause colds can also trigger attacks. Sometimes even exercise can bring on an attack. Different people have different triggers. Often, avoiding triggers is the best way to avoid an asthma attack, but it can be hard to avoid triggers like tree pollen or polluting gases such as ozone in the air. An overactive immune system. The airway swelling in many people with asthma comes from an overactive immune system. Our immune system is like a large army of blood cells that protect the body. Some of those cells are general soldiers. Others work as snipers with specific targets. Still others act more like lookouts. They warn the rest of the army of incoming threats. Let's see if I can pronounce this. Eosinophils. Eosinophils are one type of lookout cells. In the lungs, eosinophils can send messages to recruit other immune cells to fight threats. But in some people with asthma, they work too aggressively. If overactive, they can recruit too many soldiers to the lungs, and this can cause the airways to narrow. Fortunately, narrow airways can be treated with asthma inhalers. These devices disperse medicine into the throat, usually as a very fine powder. As you inhale, this fine powder gets drawn into the smallest branches of the lungs. There it can widen the airways by relaxing muscles surrounding the lungs' branching tunnels. Inhalers come in all different shapes and strengths of medication, says Cohen. Not everybody needs medication every day. Some people only need it sometimes. However, traditional inhalers may not be enough for people with severe asthma. To help these people, scientists have developed injectable medications over the past two decades. These shots are being prescribed to a small but growing number of people. Called biologics, these treatments work in a different way than drugs and asthma inhalers. Instead of relaxing muscles, they act directly on the immune cells that trigger swelling. Biologics get their name from the fact that they are not simple lab-made chemicals. Instead, they are large molecules such as proteins produced by living organisms. Some can even be whole genes. Some biologics for asthma treat overactive eosinophils. They keep those cells from signaling other immune cells. Another biologic prevents target cells from receiving eosinophils' signals. In each case, these therapies reduce how many immune cells move into the lungs. And fewer immune cells mean less swelling and easier breathing. Biologics can help prevent frequent asthma attacks, notes Khalil Gates. She's a lung doctor at Northwestern Medicine there in Chicago. People receiving biologics won't need to use an inhaler as much, though they may still need one from time to time. Biologics won't help everyone with severe asthma, says Gates. Most of the biologics require a certain amount of eosinophils in the blood. So doctors may do a blood test to check for levels of these before prescribing biologics. But she says, biologics have really been helpful in a subset of people. Medications matter. Biologics helped one of Cohen's young patients with severe asthma. For years, the patient could not go to the park, could not go to the playground and run around at all, she says. He ended up in the hospital multiple times a year. Once he started using a biologic, he didn't have to go to the hospital. He even stopped missing school days because of his asthma, Cohen says. One downside is that biologics have to be given as a shot. They can't be given as a pill or inhaler. Most people get the shots once a month, though some must be given more frequently. Let's see, in 2025, it is so exciting to be able to give really good asthma treatment for people, even if their asthma is severe. Juliana says her asthma doesn't keep her from doing most things. The reason? She has the right medications and knows how to use them. I feel like as long as you are diagnosed and you have what you need, it doesn't stop you. Okay, let's go back to Dogo News. Got a couple of more articles that are interesting here. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano erupts with rare lava fountains reaching 1,000 feet. That's up there. Kavi Dalazia wrote this. The Kilauea volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii is famous for its frequent eruptions and breathtaking displays of molten lava. But recent activities has been even more spectacular than usual. Some lava fountains have soared as high as 1,000 feet. Such eruptions have not been seen in over 65 years. The latest series of eruptions began around 2:20 a.m. local time on December 23rd of 2024. Lava fountains initially reached nearly 300 feet into the sky. By the following day, the lava had spread across 650 acres of the crater floor. Since then, the eruptions have stopped and started 17 times. Some have lasted just 16 hours. Others have continued for up to 12 days. The most recent event from April 7th to April 9th of 2025 produced much smaller lava bursts. They range between 15 and 30 feet. Based on previous patterns, experts expect taller lava fountains to follow soon. Unlike in past years, the eruptions pose no threat to nearby residents. The lava remains contained within the caldera, a wide, bowl-shaped crater at the volcano's summit. That makes it safe for people to view the eruptions from a distance. No one knows how long the activity will continue, but for now, it is drawing visitors from around the world. Kilauea is now known as the world's youngest and most active. It is one of the most youngest and active volcanoes. But for a long time, it was believed to be part of the larger Mauna Loa volcano. That view shifted way back in 1884 when scientists found that Kilauea had its own magma system stretching more than 37 miles underground. From then on, it was recognized as a volcano in its own right. Many Hawaiians believe Kilauea's eruptions are guided by Pele, the goddess of volcanoes and fire. According to local legend, Pele, one of six daughters and seven sons born to the earth goddess Haumea and the universe creator Kane Malohai, was banished to Hawaii from Tahiti. She traveled through the Hawaiian Islands, creating volcanoes along the way. On Maui, she fought a fierce battle with her sister, Nemaka, the goddess of the sea, and was killed. However, her spirit is said to live on in the summit of Kilauea. Next article. Sticking with Dogo, newly discovered green comet is dazzling sky watchers. Kavi Dalazia wrote this one too. A glowing green comet is captivating sky watchers across the northern hemisphere. Comet C2025F2, or SWAN, was first spotted by amateur astronomer Michael Mariazzo, back March 29th, of 2025. He discovered it while looking through images from the Solar Wind Anisotropes camera aboard NASA's Solar Heliospheric Observatory. Since then, the comet has been seen multiple times with the help of telescopes. Comet SWAN is expected to make its closest approach to the sun on May 1st of this year, 2025, passing just 31 million miles away. That's closer than Mercury, the innermost planet to the sun. It will also reach its closest point to Earth on that same day, coming within 89.5 million miles. How to spot Comet SWAN? Thanks to its position in the northern skies, the next 2 weeks will offer the best viewing opportunities from the northern hemisphere. Comet SWAN will be visible in the early morning sky through April 24th, 2025. Stargazers should seek out an unobstructed view and look northeast at least 70 minutes before sunrise. Starting April 25th, the comet will shift to the west-northwest horizon and be visible shortly after sunset. Experts suggest waiting at least 70 minutes after sunset for the best view. The comet will fade from the northern hemisphere skies around May 8th. Southern hemisphere viewers will join the party around May 4th. They will enjoy views of the comet through the rest of May. Unless the comet brightens significantly, you will need binoculars or a small telescope to see it.
While it appears green in photos, it will likely look fuzzy white light to the naked eye. The green glow in images comes from the gas around the comet that glows when hit by sunlight, but it is very faint, so our eyes usually cannot see it. Cameras, however, can pick it up, making the comet appear even striking in pictures. And one more article in Dogo. Easter traditions around the world. Emily Moulin wrote this. Easter, which will be observed on April 20th, is the oldest and most important of all Christian festivals. The holiday celebrates the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Many adults in the U.S. observe it by attending special church services. Some also fast or give up certain foods or habits for 40 days leading up to Easter. For American kids, the holiday centers around egg hunts, parades, and the Easter Bunny. But not all countries follow these traditions, no. Here are a few unique Easter celebrations from around the world. Okay, you got Bermuda. In Bermuda, the Friday before Easter is marked by flying kites and eating hot cross buns and codfish cakes. Why, that's funny. The kite flying tradition is believed to have been started by a teacher trying to explain the ascension of Jesus Christ to his students. He launched a kite with the likeness of Christ, and a fun custom was born. The hot cross bun tradition was inherited from the British. Let's see, the codfish is a chance to avoid meat during Lent. Then there's Norway. Norwegians spend the week-long Easter holiday reading crime novels and watching murder mystery shows. To meet demand, publishers release new thrillers while television channels broadcast crime dramas at Easter. Even dairy companies join in with crime-related cartoons on milk cartons. The custom began with a 1923 newspaper ad for a crime novel that appeared on the front page a week before Easter. Many readers mistook it for an actual news article. This clever stunt increased sales and promoted publishers to release crime novels around Easter. Television producers soon followed, and a tradition was born. And in Greece, the Saturday before Easter, residents of Corfu, Greece, throw water-filled clay jugs, known as botides, onto the streets. The tradition, which welcomes spring, is believed to have been inspired by Italians. In Italy, people toss old dishes out of their windows on New Year's Eve to signify they're ready for a fresh start, or at least a fresh set of dishes. See, Italy, on Easter Sunday, hundreds of Italians dress in 15th century attire, escort an antique cart filled with fireworks to the Florence Cathedral. During Easter Mass, the Archbishop of Florence lights a fuse, setting off a vibrant fireworks display. This lively tradition dates back over 350 years. It is believed to bring good luck to the harvest and the year ahead. Then it says, Happy Easter! And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.